Now, the opening of the government's books yesterday ahead of the election painted a picture of long-term debt, rising unemployment and a slow recovery. The Treasury figures predict unemployment to reach a peak of 7.8% in March 2022, which is down from earlier forecasts of 10% by this month. But that jobless rate will remain higher for longer. The figures were based on the assumption that the borders would remain largely closed until 2022, or rather they would open in January 2022. It does accept there may be some limited international travel from mid-2021. The Finance Minister, Grant Robertson, has been quick to say that the borders remaining closed till 2022 may not be the case. The latest GDP or gross domestic product figures for the 3 months to June are due out later this morning, and they're expected to show the biggest economic contraction on record and that New Zealand is officially in a deep recession. Well, with us now for analysis, we welcome BUL Chief Economist Ganesh Nana. Hi, Ganesh.
Kia ora.
And good morning also to ANZ Chief Economist Sharon Zolner.
Morena.
Ganesh, could you begin, please, your take on the state of the books revealed yesterday? They were described by the Treasury Secretary, Carolee McLeish, as less negative for the near term than had been predicted in the budget update. But frankly, we've not seen anything like it, have we?
No, we've not seen anything like it, but we also should not be surprised. It is a very, it's a stark reality that we all really need to understand that this was, as many have said, a 1 in 100 year crisis, if not more. It was never going to be solved overnight. There was never going to be a sudden V-shaped recovery back to normal next year. This is a long haul. This is a big shock. There is no glossing over it. And whichever route we took early in March this year was always going to hurt.
Can we first talk about the unemployment predictions? There's no doubt that the wage subsidy has covered a multitude of sins. In fact, until recently, there was still something like 1 million New Zealand workers who were on that wage subsidy. With that coming to an end, what is your comment on Treasury's unemployment projections? Do they look about right in your view?
They're closer to what I thought was going to happen, definitely closer than their previous forecast. I think they're probably, unfortunately, a tad on the optimistic side, but not significantly so. I said right at the start that if we keep unemployment rate in single digits, we would have done well. And I think that's still a scenario that we might end up with. But it's going to hurt for a lot of people for a lot longer. But in comparison, we had unemployment rates at 11.5% in the early 1990s. So if we've done better than that for a 1 in 100 year shock, I know it's of no comfort for those who are going to be out of jobs. But in comparison, we're probably going to... glass half full rather than glass half empty in that regard.
What is the underlying assumption that sees this unemployment remaining higher for longer, stretching well out? It's still going to be above 5% by quarter two of 2024, which is 4 years away, till we're getting back to where we were pre-COVID. What are the underlying assumptions driving that, Ganesh?
The Treasury are pointing to a much weaker external environment, so they're looking a little bit gloomier in terms of the world. I think it's a combination of both. There was never going to be a quick recovery. There is the unemployment rate that's going to cycle back into people's incomes. There's a question mark about what the response is from government in terms of shoring people's incomes up. And I think that's the unknown on the domestic side, what is going to happen to that wage subsidy or that income support element of government policy post-election.
Sharon Zolner, if I could bring you in just on the unemployment specifically. I mean, we're looking right through to 2022 with that unemployment peak staying up around 7.5%. And again, this is just still a projection, right? Do you see it as being on the optimistic side?
Well, it was definitely too optimistic last time in terms of the speed at which they were assuming the unemployment rate would come down. Essentially, they sort of had the economy just going back to normal very, very quickly, which isn't a particularly realistic in this particular shock, where we need to basically reshape and evolve, which means people need to at least change regions, possibly change careers. You know, there's a lot of sort of lags in there in terms of how quickly that can happen. We're actually a little more pessimistic about the very near term, because unfortunately the sectors that are being most affected here, tourism, retail, hospitality, they actually punch above their weight in terms of their share of employment versus their share of GDP. So if you take that into account, then the hit to employment is bigger than if this GDP shock were because it wasn't raining and cows were producing less milk, for example. So we actually see the unemployment rate peaking closer to 10%. But I think they are on the money, unfortunately, that it is going to be quite persistent. And that is, of course, a lot of concern to the government, because the longer people are unemployed, you know, if you fall off that boat, it can be very, very difficult to get back on.
Sharon, what gets counted and what doesn't in unemployment as well? Either, I mean, I can think of examples of people working in the tourism industry who can see the writing on the wall for a time and have gone back studying, for example. Are there those who are going to be doing occasional or intermittent work who aren't going to be counted? Like, does it reveal anything like the full picture?
The official definition of unemployment was never designed with lockdown in mind, that's for sure. So there was widespread discounting of the June quarter reported numbers. But even beyond that scenario, it is deliberately quite narrow, because people who are not looking for work shouldn't be counted. So people who have gone back to study, for example, or people who are choosing to stay home with the children or are choosing to retire or whatever. But there is a grey zone, because people can be enticed into the labour market or they can be discouraged out of it. So in that regard, a broader measure of underemployment is really useful. When you ask people, would you be working more hours if you could? Is it economic reasons that are preventing you from working more hours? That comes closer to what most people would think of as an unfortunate hit to people's employment preferences. So that we'll be certainly keeping an eye on that measure going forward. We would expect that to rise quite a lot as well.
Sharon, we get the GDP figures out at 11 o'clock. I'm just going to ask each of you now, let's look at the next component of this, which is the big hit to GDP, the shrinking of the economy, and then we'll talk about its implications. What are you picking it to be at 11?
We're picking minus 12, but to be fair, the forecasting process this time was pretty unique. We were not trying to forecast what happened to the economy. We were trying to forecast the judgment statistics New Zealand would apply to this experimental data they have never used to calculate GDP before. So the number will come out. It will be a number. It will be hideous. It will be revised. GDP revisions never get much press, but I would expect this number to swing around wildly over the next few years, and where it settles may or may not reflect what really happened. There's a lot of noise because, just like, you know, unemployment methodology was never designed for lockdown, nor was GDP methodology. So whatever the number is, I think we will look through it to some degree. If it's a bigger fall than we expect, we'll put in a bigger bounce in the third quarter, and vice versa.
So let's talk about its real significance. When it comes to the big things, to people's earnings, household incomes, job security, and ultimately the tax revenue of the government and the ability to pay for services. When you look through numbers we can't really comprehend, because this is a particular event, what are you looking for, Sharon? What is it that we are in for over the next few years?
Well, I find it useful to think about this COVID event as three separate shocks. There was the lockdown and the bounce out of it. Now, the bounce has been spectacularly rapid, much quicker than anyone anticipated, but it's got this incredible tailwind from fiscal stimulus, which is unsustainable. This wage subsidy is huge. So it's good news, but it's artificial to some extent. Then you've got the medium-term impact, which is focused on the border. So taking into account Kiwis can't go offshore on holiday, that's good for GDP, but also the people who can't come in, the spillovers into retail, hospitality, that's probably worth 5% of the economy, but it's incredibly seasonal. It's a summer story, so we haven't actually really felt that yet. There will be a whole lot of tourism firms who are sitting on quite a lot of cash after a good season, plus the wage subsidy, but knowing their number is up when that wage subsidy runs out and those tourists don't arrive. And then the third wave of this is the international situation and the slowdown in our trading partners. So, of course, all the other countries have been throwing the kitchen sink at this as well in terms of fiscal and monetary stimulus. So we're not the only country that's seen a stronger bounce back than expected, but the medium term is still very, very murky. And then over that, you can also overlay the whole migration question. Migration's been incredibly important for the New Zealand economy in the last 5 years, and it's just gone to zero. So that has massive implications as well.
Except that we are hearing anecdotally, and I'm curious as to how you try and calculate this, there might be a lot of New Zealanders planning to move permanently home.
Yes, but net migration was minus 26 in July. So it's gone, it's basically zero. So yes, there is a queue of Kiwis coming in, but there's a very narrow bottleneck there trying to get through. But there's also a queue of people trying to get out. It's very unclear what the fate of foreigners, visa holders, even stranded tourists in New Zealand is going to be, when and how are they going to depart. So although the returning diaspora gets a lot of attention, the aggregate numbers have plummeted. So that is a very different outlook.
Ganesh, same question to you. We're going to be looking at some really odd numbers at 11 that many of us can't even get our heads around. Again, if I ask you what it means, what does it mean for the next few years for household incomes, for jobs, and then the flow through of revenue into the government's books, which of course affects questions over provision of services and spending? When you look at it from that perspective, what are you seeing for the next few years?
Well, I think we've got to get past this fixation on specific numbers, and in particular numbers that really don't mean much, like the GDP number at 11 o'clock this morning. It is only of interest to geeks like myself in terms of academic interest. The real numbers are what you signal around household incomes, people in jobs, people that have been disconnected from the labour market or their communities. And I think that's the critical element that we need to monitor going forward. How do we make sure that those that have been left on the sidelines in terms of jobs or in terms of communities, how do we make sure they remain engaged, whether it's through training programs or whether it's through voluntary work or whether it's through some other form of assistance that ensures that they remain connected to their communities and their work and their families, and indeed in the end their economies, because that is what will make the medium to longer term recovery a lot easier. The longer we have these short term disconnections, that just embeds in a whole lot of people that opt out or feel left vulnerable, feel left out, and so left less engaged. And I think that's the looking much further beyond the next couple of years, the task for us here and now is to make sure that we look after those vulnerable and those least resilient, so that we can, I suppose, re-engineer the economic mechanism so that we are not so vulnerable to shocks like this, or vulnerable to or reliant on migrants coming in.
It's not looking good, is it? It was Cameron Baggery yesterday of Baggery Economics who pointed out that the figures released yesterday by Treasury mean the number on the job seeker and emergency benefit in 2024 is projected to be 246,000. That was up from 180,000 projected in May's budget. So that's a slower recovery. We also know that women, Māori and Pacifica, and the youth are being hardest hit by this. Ganesh, and to both of your points, a long disconnect from the labour market is not a good thing.
Exactly.
And can we talk a little bit about things politicians don't seem to be wanting to talk about at the moment? What sort of policies do we need to bear in mind to try and manage through that, Ganesh?
Well, I think that the first point is, yes, it's not looking good, but the second point is that the government has a whole lot of ammunition left to spend, and we have to get past this idea of focusing on, yes, I know the numbers yesterday were horrible in terms of deficits and debts, but in comparison to other parts of the world, the government still has a lot left that it could do, and we need to encourage or at least make sure that this government or whatever government comes in post-October is not reluctant to go out there and ensure that we spend in the right areas, that is, spend in the areas that will maintain the connections for those that are most vulnerable. And I find it quite interesting that literally overnight the OECD has come out with a very strong report about making sure that government does not withdraw the fiscal supports that are in place. Do not withdraw them too quickly. And that comment was made across the board to all governments. And I think that's very important for this country. Let's not get too concerned about the government's books, because to be honest, the government's books are not the issue. The problem is very much the damage that is being done to those who are most vulnerable, Māori, young, women, those that are always the ones at the front of the queue when it comes to being laid off or being left on the side. And we've got to make sure that they remain in the waka, so to speak, and remain connected and feel engaged so that when the recovery does come, it makes it a lot easier for all of us.
Sharon Zollner, can we talk about debt? It's the subject of a lot of discussion. Again, it's eye-watering. I mean, if we look at this globally again, we know we came in from a pretty healthy position using that net debt to GDP measure. I think we'd got under 20%. It's going to peak at 55%, according to these latest figures, around 2024, I think it is. Might be 2023, 2024. And again, we're projecting. But the question then about debt becomes the intergenerational fairness. You're looking at budget deficits for the next 15 years, which takes away the ability to start to tackle some of that debt. And the real question is, how much do you worry about it, and how much do you try and bring it down, and how quickly? From your perspective, what is it people need to be thinking about and talking about?
Well, I think there's an underappreciation perhaps of how good our starting position is. We are pretty tough on ourselves in terms of how we actually report our net debt. If we took the super fund into account, our numbers are spectacularly good, or were. I have to use past tense here. So that does mean we can kick the discussion of how to pay it back further down the track. So that sort of feeds into the, well, let's throw the kitchen sink at this argument. On the other hand, statistically, the odds of the Alpine fault going are increasing every year, not decreasing. And there's a lot of other faults around New Zealand. So and many other things that could go wrong. They are quite vulnerable to shocks as a small, very active nation that, you know, is at the end of the world and reliant on China and in a slightly tricky spot in terms of global geopolitics at the moment. You know, there's no shortage of other things that could happen, although everyone's focus is on COVID at the moment. So in that regard, you could make a case for the fact that we need to have strong books because we have risks that are not so relevant for other countries. But the other interesting thing is, if you look at government defaults over history, it's not a linear thing. People don't sort of get a bit worried and then a little bit more worried and then a little bit more worried. Everything is fine, and then it flips on a dime, and suddenly it's not, because the math changes sort of exponentially. If people start to build in a little bit more risk on someone's government debt and the interest rate starts to go up for that reason, then suddenly the debt servicing costs lift a little bit more, and then suddenly everyone jumps on the same bandwagon. So I'm not at all suggesting that New Zealand is in that boat, but globally, government debt is just going nuts, and there's real question marks around what happens when interest rates rise for whatever reason, either a repricing of risk or some sort of inflation risk that's hard to see at the moment, but over a long enough horizon is inevitable.
Ganesh?
I'd probably tautoko what Sharon has said. We need to stop being so hard on ourselves about debt, about government debt. It's not the problem. The question is, who are we owing this debt to? And effectively, we're owing it to ourselves. There's the intergenerational aspect of it. But if we try and repay it now quickly, there's still the intergeneration aspect of leaving so many people aside, i.e. reducing spending now, go down the austerity route, pat ourselves on the back and pay off the debt to ourselves now. That leaves a big hole for the future in terms of a debt in a different form, a debt in the form of community dislocation, infrastructure deficit, a whole lot of people left untrained and unskilled and unable to contribute in the future. So it's not an either or, it's a both, and we need to balance that out. So let's, okay, look at the financial debt, but let's also look at those other forms of debt, and that's the balance that we've got to strike. So I'm reassured by the minister yesterday in saying he's not keen on the austerity route, but I balance that out by this idea of this ongoing fixation of wanting to bring debt down quickly. Seriously, 55% a peak. Comparing to other parts of the globe, we're not even a speck. We're not going to appear on that horizon. We've got a fair bit of elbow room if we definitely did measure it properly, if we include how much we've set aside for the superannuation fund. That real measure of debt is really not the problem.
Yeah.
The problem is the long-term scarring if we leave many people, the vulnerable people, to one side.
Sharon, the other thing that people repeatedly point out, though, is that our private debt is a completely different picture and is a serious risk in some ways. How do those two things interact, private debt and government debt?
Well, ratings agencies view them as one and the same, because you get something like the GFC, then private debt can become public debt with a stroke of a pen if you had to bail out the banking system. So we are all in this together. But in New Zealand, household debt is at record highs, but it's crept up there rather than soaring. So the quality of the lending in terms of the safety of the banking system is far better than it was in 2007, for example. So in that regard, it's less of a financial stability risk. But it basically, whether you're a household or a firm or a government, if you've got a lot of debt and something bad happens, you've got a lot fewer options. You're less nimble. And so the debt loadings do matter from that point of view, even if interest rates are low and so the servicing cost isn't high. It is still an impediment on how nimble you can be and how well you can get through negative events. But our corporate debt is extremely low. In fact, you could argue we would be in a better position now if firms had borrowed and actually invested a bit more, because in the end, our long-run fiscal position is really tied to our productivity growth. If we want to have any shot of growing our way out of this, as opposed to having to undergo the kind of austerity that we all want to avoid, we need to grow the economy faster. So, infrastructure spending is part of that. That's difficult to do quickly, but it's kind of the easy bit because, reforms to the labour market and that sort of thing are politically much more challenging. But everything needs to be on the table. Our productivity performance has been dire, and if it were spectacular, then debt would be less of a problem.
Can I ask you about this other conversation that is happening and has been happening for a while, and we're getting towards, nearer towards it anyway, which is the idea of direct financing, essentially of the government, of the Reserve Bank printing money and directly funding government, cutting out intermediaries. It sounds like a nirvana. There's more and more people having conversations about it. What are the downsides of going too far down that route of just filling up your bank account out of your Reserve Bank and spending away, Sharon? What are the risks around that model going too far?
Yeah, well, as an economist, you do sort of develop a sniff test for that is something too good to be true. And the modern monetary theory idea that you just keep printing money and you can solve climate change, you can, solve unemployment, you can do everything, that definitely fails the magic wand, too good to be true test. It is actually a pretty fine line between quantitative easing and monetisation of government deficits. It's just a bit of a veneer of respectability in that you buy the bonds off people who have bought them from the government. That does incur extra costs, of course. So there are those that argue, well, for goodness sake, let's cut out the middleman and just not pretend about this anymore. But in actual fact, if the government owes the money to itself, the Reserve Bank is in the arm of government. They could write it off, but then they would actually technically have to bail out the Reserve Bank. So you can't actually quite get around it that way. But there's also the ratings agencies to consider. You just don't want to end up in the Banana Republic basket with people thinking that you're trying to just inflate your way out of it. I mean, basically, central banks have been doing everything they can to devalue the internal and external value of their currencies. And generate inflation and exchange rate depreciation without any luck over recent years. But you can't rule out that they may at some point overachieve on that front.
Ganesh, your view?
To me, they're flip sides of the same coin. I don't see a huge distinction. The risk, I worry the fixation with credit rating agencies. The risk for credit rating agencies only if we are borrowing from abroad. If we borrow from amongst ourselves, i.e. between New Zealanders, there's not an issue. The biggest constraint is our ability to lift productivity. So the constraint is the real economic constraint. Do we have people, do we have skilled people that are engaged, that are able to provide jobs, set up businesses, deliver services? That's the real economic challenge in front of us. It's not constrained by how much money we print. It is constrained a bit by how much we might have to borrow from overseas. We've got enough resources here in domestically within New Zealand to tackle that. As I've said before, the biggest constraint is how many of those resources we lose over the side by leaving them disconnected and disillusioned over the interim.
Thanks, both of you. Really appreciate it. Sharon Zollner is the ANZ Chief Executive, and Ganesh Nana was just speaking to there as Bill's, Chief Economist. She'd probably like to be CEO. She's ANZ's Chief Economist, and Ganesh Nana is Bill's Chief Economist.